Welcome to the Red Rock Fantasy Football Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Schultz. I'm joined by John Lobb. How are you doing today, John?
I'm doing great. The humidity broke on the East Coast, and it's a little more comfortable. And football season is just around the corner.
That's nice. I'm jealous. It's been, you know, 102, 103 degrees over here where I'm at, so I would kill for it to, you know, cool down a little bit.
I didn't know it was that hot out there.
Oh yeah, it's been pretty warm out here in Idaho this year. But you know, that's the life, I guess. So we'll go ahead and move on to some news that kind of broke this morning in the NFL. The Tennessee Titans traded Dorial Green-Beckham from Tennessee to Philadelphia in exchange for an offensive lineman, Dennis Kelly, kind of a depth offensive lineman playing, plays a little guard tackle. First things first, what do you see happening with DGB's fantasy value in Philadelphia? Would you say he's rising, dropping, or staying the same?
That's a very interesting question, because when I began my draft process way back in March, I kind of thought DGB had some fantasy value. He was kind of a nice rising sophomore. The skill set was clearly there. I was a little bit lower on him coming out of the 2015 draft compared to other experts, but you had to be intrigued by the size and the athletic ability. But then the news, if you've really been watching, Mularkey is an old school coach, and he has really been all over Dorial Green-Beckham. I mean, I kind of like it. That's what I grew up with, challenging athletes and young men to rise to the occasion. And I think what happened is Mularkey expected or hoped that DGB would accept the challenge and that he would become the player that the Titans had envisioned when they drafted him. But obviously, I don't have the privilege of seeing him practice every day. But obviously, Mularkey felt and the Titans staff felt that at this point, he just was not ready to become the professional wide receiver that Tennessee needed to take it to the next level and hopefully make the playoffs. So to me, I'm a little concerned that the Eagles basically just gave up a backup offensive lineman. So that also tells me the Titans were just looking to get him off the roster. Now, maybe the young man has a wake-up call and Doug Peterson can tap into something and that potential that Mularkey was not able to. Because we know that young men respond differently to certain types of motivation and certain types of communication. Maybe Peterson's personality and the way he works with young men, maybe it'll bring out the promise in DGB. I'm not convinced of that. I have not drafted DGB in any league so far. One is it seems like he was going at an ADP or a round that I was not comfortable with. So in almost every league, there was an owner who was really high on the potential. So I never got him. And right now, going to Philadelphia, trying to learn a new system, trying to learn a new verbiage for the offensive playbook, and trying to mature as a young man, I'm not really going to draft DGB at all this year. I don't see him landing on my roster. So I think it lowers his draft value, and I'm not optimistic in a low-volume Philadelphia Eagles offense that DGB will be productive.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, when you're talking about, you know, there's always that one owner in every league that was super high on him. Coming into his rookie year, I was that owner. I grabbed him in, you know, both of my dynasty leagues. I mean, I think in a redraft league, you're not touching him, so you don't have to worry about it much there. But, like, you know, if you're in a dynasty league or, you know, maybe even a deep redraft league, you know, I had him in both of them. But this offseason, I did cut bait in both of my leagues that I had him in. You know, one of them, I'm in a dynasty league, but it's a win. I'm on a win now team. I won last year, so I'm going for, you know, a repeat. So I flipped him for Jonathan Stewart and a draft pick. I still like that move for me this year. But, you know, you look at him going over to Philadelphia, I think, you know, Jordan Matthews is clearing away the number one there. But then you look past there, you know, you got Reuben Randall, Josh Huff, Riley Cooper, Nelson Agholor. No one that, you know, I mean, Agholor there definitely has the highest upside out of all of them, but none of those guys are guys that I'm really banking on being, you know, a wide receiver two on a winning NFL team. I mean, the opportunity is still there for DGB to produce, you know, opposite of Jordan Matthews. I'm just not sure that that's necessarily going to go like going to happen this year. If you have him in a dynasty league, I'd still stash him. I would still be holding him. I wouldn't be looking to sell low unless you can get, you know, a good deal, you know, get a good solid piece. But, you know, looking at the Tennessee depth chart, I think that that opens up a lot of opportunity for a couple different guys. Yeah, I do like, you know, rookie Tajae Sharpe. I do like him quite a bit. I know you, I've looking at your Twitter feed this morning, I think you like him quite a bit too. I do still like Kendall Wright in PPR leagues. I think he could have a little bit of a bounce back year this year. Obviously, I think, you know, the biggest thing, it opens up a spot for definitely Andre Johnson. So looking at the Tennessee wide receiver situation right now, how are you valuing them coming into this draft?
So this is very interesting because I think most fans are going to focus on the DGB narrative of this trade. But we know that there's two sides and two perspectives in every trade. And what is very interesting to me is the Tennessee side and their depth chart. So the two players that stick out the most to me looking at Tennessee right now, clearly the first one is Tajae Sharpe. He's 6 feet, 217 pounds. I digress. He is 6'3", 200 pounds. And ever since the OTAs, the reports have been incredibly positive out of Tennessee. Now, while he was with the Minutemen, he worked outside the numbers and in the slot. So I like his versatility as a pass catcher in the offense. You also have to look at productivity. Tajae Sharpe was incredibly productive in a very poor team last year. He caught 111 passes for 1,319 yards and 9 touchdowns. There's a couple things that stand out in his scouting report that have been confirmed by coaches and people who have talked to him. He is very coachable. And I think that has become evident throughout these OTAs. And one of the reasons why Mularkey vaulted him to the top of the depth chart so early. I think there was two parts of this story, and I was never sure which part to pay attention to most. Was it to motivate DGB, or was Sharpe just that good? At first, I thought it was to motivate DGB. But now after this trade, I'm convinced that the coaching staff just believes that Tajae Sharpe is that good. He's a humble competitor who wins one-on-one matchups. He runs very good routes, and he reaches top-end speed quickly. He has good footwork and reliable hands. I think the kid is going to start. Now, it's a low-volume passing game, and we know the Titans are going to play smash-mouth football with that incredible offensive line and that stable of running backs. So I don't expect a ton of production out of the wide receivers. But Tajae Sharpe in dynasty leagues and maybe late in large 12-team, 17-round redraft leagues, I think Tajae Sharpe has value. Now, the other one, interesting. I'm going to bypass Andre Johnson. I just have no interest in him at his age at this time.
Oh, yeah, I'm not touching him anywhere.
Yeah, so the one that I'm very interested, it comes down to Kendall Wright or Rishard Matthews. And right now, I'm really looking at Rishard Matthews, and he's the one who I'm interested in. Last year for the Dolphins, early in the season, before Devontae Parker really got incorporated into that Miami offense in the passing game, Rishard Matthews was very productive. At the end of the year, he caught 43 passes for over 600 yards and 10 touchdowns. He also had a 70% catch rate. And he's a 6 foot, 217 pounder, and he can block. So I think Rishard Matthews and Tajae Sharpe with the big bodies and their ability and the coaching ability and their blocking ability, I think they're going to get on the field. So those are the two guys that I'm looking at. I agree with you in three receiver sets. And when they might be in third and long, I think Kendall Wright will get on the field. But this is a low volume passing game. I don't know how much productivity the third wide receiver on the Titans is going to get this year.
Well, yeah, not only that, when you're talking about the low-volume passing game, you have to factor in Delanie Walker there as well. He's going to, you know, soak up his fair share of targets as well.
Absolutely.
So kind of moving on a little bit here, I want to, you know, kind of do a little bit of a grade the trade on a trade that I made this past week in a Dynasty PPR league. I was pretty stacked at wide receiver. I needed to add a running back. So I flipped Eric Decker straight up for DeMarco Murray in a dynasty league. Which side do you like on that?
Interested. I would have made the trade of Eric Decker for DeMarco Murray. So I think I'm with you. I'm on the DeMarco Murray side. Now, the only question, is it a PPR league?
Yes, it is PPR.
So I still like DeMarco Murray. Because DeMarco Murray, to me, is more valuable in PPR leagues. And he does clearly have value in standard leagues. But I'm a DeMarco Murray fanatic. I think he's a very good football player. I think last year is going to turn out to be an anomaly, not the norm, or the dip in his career. I think you did well. I think you can reach for wide receivers in PPR leagues. I think you can uncover a decent, productive slot receiver in a PPR league. I think it is much more difficult to find a productive every down back in a PPR league. So I definitely would have made that trade, DeMarco Murray, for Eric Decker, and I would want to be on the DeMarco Murray side.
Yep, that was kind of my thought exactly. And like, you know, I kind of mentioned a little bit before, I was, you know, deep at wide receiver, and I needed, you know, he's going to step in as my, like, you know, RB1, RB2 now, Murray, that is. You know, you look at Decker last year, you know, I obviously enjoyed owning him last year. He helped me win a lot of games. But, you know, you look at him, he had 12 touchdowns last year. And I'm just not sure that he can sustain that number again. I think, you know, banking on him to have back-to-back 12-plus touchdown seasons is kind of foolish. You think he'd probably drop back down, you know, closer to like that 7-9 range, due to my prediction, because I still think Brandon Marshall is going to get his fair share of the workload over there in New York. You know, they just added Matt Forte, who's going to soak up some of the passing game targets. So yeah, it was a move I had to make. You know, normally in dynasty leagues, I'm on the side of the wide receivers. But like you mentioned with PPR and me being already pretty deep there, I felt pretty good about that. And it was a move I thought I had to make. So I'm glad to, you know, see that you're on my side for that one.
Yeah, I definitely think you made the savvy move. I think you did the right roster management.
Yes, absolutely. And that kind of leads us into, you know, the next topic we want to talk about, you know, is that, you know, is DFS, and I guess to a sense, fantasy football in general, is it, you know, is it more of an art or a science? And, you know, for me...
That is a great...
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I would say for me, it's...
No, go ahead. I'm sorry, Jordan. I apologize.
Yeah, no problem. For me, it's definitely, I would say it's more of an art because, you know, you look at the numbers that are just raw. In a PPR league, Eric Decker outscored DeMarco Murray by quite a bit last year. There's a chance that, you know, in a PPR league, he could put up those higher numbers. But you can't just, you know, for me personally, I can't just put, you know, numbers into a spreadsheet, add it all up, divide it, and then come out with like some magic formula to determine which guys I like, which guys I don't. I think there's so much more you have to take into it. You have to, you know, you have to look at, you know, situation, you know, things like what trades have they made? What are, you know, following the news through the preseason? It's not an exact science on how I come up with my thing. So I would definitely lean more on the side that, you know, DFS is, and fantasy football in general is more of an art than a science. What side of the argument do you come down on that?
So after 28 years of playing, I would have said the first 14 years, I definitely attacked fantasy football as an art. There were a couple reasons. I played long before there was an internet. I played long before there was 24-hour sports news. I used to have to watch primetime on ESPN at 7 o'clock, and I would devour every piece of information that Chris Berman and Tom Jackson gave me. I would then stay up until 11:30 at night watching all the highlights. And I had to get my ESPN magazine or newspaper on Monday mornings to actually see the box scores and find out how some of my players did. And there was definitely an art aspect to this because you had to go on a lot of reports that you had read. You had to go on a lot of opinions that you had respected and then kind of process them on your own. Now, the internet has really changed everything in the popularity of the game. I definitely believe there's a science component to fantasy football. I'm a nerd, so I like my little spreadsheets. I like to look things up. Even when I was in art, I used to have my notepad, and I would look for the worst defenses in the league, and I would look at depth charts. But I didn't do it as scientifically. I did it by hand. So there was clearly the artistic aspect of finding matchups that you liked. Now, I definitely use my spreadsheet. And in cash games, I try to be on the scientific side. But if you're doing GPPs or you're competing in season long, I still think there is the artistic side. Because we mentioned DeMarco Murray. I think if you go by the stats and you listen to everyone, you might focus too much on what DeMarco Murray did last year as an Eagle. And you might give so much credit to the Dallas offensive line 2 years ago that you downgrade DeMarco Murray. However, from the art side, I like DeMarco Murray because I love his basic skill set and his athletic ability. I have confidence in Mike Mularkey that he is changing the demeanor of that offensive line, and he's going to pound people and pound defenses into submission because what I think Mularkey sees is a market weakness. The two-a-days are limited. The hitting is limited in training camp, and I wonder about the toughness of teams. And I think what Mularkey is doing is saying, hey, I'm going to go in with a very tough offensive line, and I'm going to wear you down, and I'm going to try to exploit these safeties that are used to covering. I'm going to exploit these smaller linebackers who are used to covering three and four receivers in space and trying to cover the running backs out of the backfield. I think he sees a market exploitation that he can take advantage of. Now, that's an art. I don't have any numbers that can prove that. We've seen it at times when Bill Belichick and the Patriots look at a weak front seven and they just pound the opponent with LeGarrette Blount. Or remember a couple years ago, we talked about this on that Monday night game where the guy came out of nowhere against the Colts for 200 yards rushing for the New England. He made the front cover of Sports Illustrated, and he was never seen again. I think that's what Mularkey's going to do. Now, if that produces 12 wins, 11 wins, and a playoff spot, that will remain to be seen. But that's kind of an art to see that coming, to watch that offensive line, to believe in the philosophy of Mike Mularkey. So I believe that you have to be the best at this game, to be the best of your abilities. You have to analyze from a scientific standpoint, but you also must have some faith in some projections, and it is an art in some ways. We can't get rid of the total artistic aspect of this great game.
Yeah, very well said. I think, I agree with you, completely on that. It is, you have to find that good mix of the art and the science to it, for sure. So, that's just, kind of a general reminder to people out there managing their teams, don't be a slave to the rankings or, a slave to like what, your favorite expert says, take, those rankings into consideration with, various opinions from all across the industry. The more you read from, the more different viewpoints you read, the better all around knowledge you're going to have of the game and the better decisions you're going to make when you're managing your teams. So, let's kind of shift gears just a little bit here, and we'll talk about, some of the, most impressive players during week one of the preseason. Starting off with a guy we've talked about quite a bit, DeMarco Murray, had an excellent, first game here in the preseason. He really showed up and, you put on a show for the fans the way that you'd want, your new running back you just traded in the offseason to do. I thought it was kind of funny. I was reading a story on, I think it was either Twitter or Facebook, but that the Titans auctioned off like the first two play calls to like the fans, like the highest bidders got to call the first two plays of the game, and the first two plays of the games went for 46 yards, and then the next three plays that the coaches called I think went for 3 or 5, and so I just thought that was kind of an interesting start to this season. I'm like, oh, that's got to make you feel confident, about your new offensive, coordinators and all that. But so let's talk about DeMarco for a little bit.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess I had a little foreshadowing, and that was by accident. It was by no stretch of the imagination planned. But I was most impressed with this offensive line. Now, I'm old. I remember the beauty of the Hogs and Joe Gibbs in the 1980s. And I used to love watching the counter trap. He would pull the offside guard, the offside tackle. He'd smash down with the tight end and the strong side offensive lineman, and you would see George Rogers and John Riggins just come around and obliterate in that power running game. I remember the beauty of the Cincinnati Bengals in the late 80s with Max Montoya and Anthony Munoz and Icky Woods and James Brooks. And I just love that power running game. I love the Giants with Otis Anderson and when they upset the Bills in the Super Bowl. I do enjoy when the Patriots would just obliterate you with LeGarrette Blount and they just pound defenses into submission. So there is a beauty to watching an artistic component of the offensive line. When you get these five men who are incredible athletes and they work together in unison and they're making the right reads and they're knocking the defensive lineman back and they're obliterating the linebacker and you just see these gaping holes. I used to joke when Emmitt Smith and the Dallas Cowboys in their Super Bowl run, it looked like the parting of the Red Sea for Emmitt Smith. There are literally times where you don't see a defensive player in the television screen. That wall of granite just obliterated people. Why I do that? I think the Titans are reaching there. I think the Dallas Cowboys are a beautiful offensive line. They can pass block. They can run block with zone and gap. They could be special if Romo stays healthy and if Ezekiel Elliott reaches the zenith that I believe he can reach. And I think the Oakland Raiders, that's why I'm interested in Latavius Murray. I think the Oakland Raiders are going to have a really interesting, strong offensive line. And the one that really I've got to put up higher now is this Tennessee Titans. Mularkey is an offensive lineman. Mularkey's old school. He's got Taylor Luan, who I loved him coming out of Michigan. He is nasty. He attacks defensive linemen. He will get some penalties. He will try to punch some people. He will try to intimidate you. I love it. Let's get dirty. Let's get nasty. I think those Titans are going to be fun to watch, and that's why I like DeMarco Murray, and that's why I like Derrick Henry, and that's why I'm all in on this Tennessee ground game.
Yep, so I think, there's not a lot of disagreement here. We both are in on DeMarco Murray this year. So, it's good to see him, putting up those good numbers to start off. Like you mentioned, that line looks like it's going to be much improved. Not to mention they just added some more offensive line depth in this recent trade. Really kind of shows that they're looking to transition that offense into, a new era under Mariota. So the next guy that, really kind of stepped up in week one of the preseason, made me very happy as a Cowboys fan who's been, clamoring for Jerry Jones to go get Romo's backup for a year or two now. Dak Prescott came and looked great, went 10 for 12. The two passes that were dropped were, just that. They were drops by the tight end. So, he should have went 12 for 12 in his opening debut. Really showed, some nice touch on a couple of passes, one to Terrence Williams down on the sideline. I really liked what I saw. Obviously you can't get too excited about 12 passing attempts. He's going to have some ups and downs, probably even just in this preseason. But I did like what I saw and was very encouraged about, what potentially could be the long-term solution for the Cowboys at quarterback after Romo. It was interesting. I was watching, some show on the internet or some show on TV that they had Jerry Jones entering a club late night, going partying it up like Jerry Jones does. One of the reporters that saw him there asked, hey, Johnny Manziel's out there, you guys need a backup, what is it about Johnny that makes you not want to have him on the team? And Jerry Jones in his own fashion just looked at the reporter and goes, Dak Prescott, and then walks into the club. So you gotta like what you're seeing there. What were your first impressions of Prescott?
So the one thing, anyone who knows me, I will not play Monday morning quarterback, and I'm very comfortable admitting when I'm wrong. I mean, obviously I take pride in my analysis, but predicting the future is always difficult, especially in fantasy football, and I've been wrong in my assessment in the past. So I'm going to wax poetically about Dak Prescott, and this is not playing Monday morning quarterback. Pre-draft rankings on footballdiehards.com, I had Dak Prescott ranked number 4 amongst the prospects. And at times I was shocked. I saw some draft nicks and draft experts rank Dak Prescott outside the top 10. I saw people like Christian Hackenberg ranked ahead of Dak Prescott. Kevin Hogan ranked ahead of Dak Prescott. And even Jacoby Brissett. And I had to shake my head. I went back to my analysis time and time again. And I kept saying, am I missing something? John, what are you doing wrong? Or are they just coming to far different conclusions than you are? But I stuck with my guns. It's on a couple podcasts I recorded. I've been on the scream at the top of the buildings. I'm all in on Dak Prescott. I think he can be a very good player. I also think he landed with the perfect organization. Look at it here. He ends up, he has a veteran quarterback, so I don't expect him to have to start from day one.
And a decent veteran to learn under at that.
Yeah, and everything I read, if you studied and analyzed Dak Prescott, the coaches loved him. All of the reports are that this is a good kid who is willing to learn. Now, I know he got in a little trouble, and I think it was a DUI.
Yeah, he did get a DUI, and I'm pretty sure that's why he dropped.
Yeah, and you know what? I was a dumb kid. We talked about this earlier. To me, that's not the worst sin a young man can do. He didn't have a history of Johnny Manziel coming out of Texas A&M. Manziel's history with partying was much deeper than Prescott's. I think Prescott's was an anomaly that he got caught. Do I think he probably has a beer here and there? Of course I do. He's a young man. But I don't think this is a situation where we should worry too much about it impacting his future. So I kind of ignored this. He also is going to a young and good offensive line. I've seen too many young quarterbacks in my years get eaten up because that offensive line cannot protect their young signal caller. The best case scenario that we can go back to is David Carr, Derek Carr's older brother. When the Texans drafted him number one coming out of Fresno State, that line was atrocious. They fed him to the Lions, and he just couldn't take it. And unfortunately, it derailed a promising career. Now, I also loved Dak Prescott in this game. And this is what I liked about him when I went back and I watched the game and I watched it, the highlights, a couple times. One, he had very good mechanics. If you look at the film between the Bulldogs and what he looked like, his mechanics have improved, which tells me he's been listening to the coaching staff. Check. Big, big promise. Two, he had command of the huddle. This was not too big of a scenario for him. He was not intimidated leading the Dallas Cowboys out in Los Angeles in his first preseason game. I mean, think about this. This kid had played LSU, Alabama, Auburn. He had been incredibly productive in college. This stage was not too big. What I liked about was his arm strength. Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that he has Jeff George arm strength or John Elway arm strength, but he has NFL level arm strength. And if you really want to look for it, look on the pass that he makes, first and 10, second series. This is what I liked. He played a lot of shotgun at Mississippi State. On this play, he is under center. Seven-step drop, my friend. And he throws a dart from 10 yards behind the field to Bryce Butler, 22-yard completion. That was a beautiful throw. His mechanics were good. I did not see a lot of that at Mississippi State because of the offensive scheme that they run. Bingo, my radar went off. This kid can play. Now, I have to be fair. He played a vanilla defense against veteran coordinator Greg Williams. He's not going to show the kid anything, but that's okay. We know what it is. He saw a lot of man coverage, but he did recognize that Dez Bryant was one-on-one, and when he recognized that, he allowed his receiver to make a play. Anyone who saw Matt Cassel, maybe Kellen Moore, Brandon Wheaton, Tim Couch way back, some of these guys, when they get to the NFL, they think they're going to have these big, wide open windows and that they're just going to their receivers. They can just throw the ball into these windows. Well, this is the NFL, my friends. This is a Spartan league. Those windows do not open up very often. You have to have confidence that the wide receiver read the play, the defense well, that he's going to get to his spot and you've got to anticipate the throw and take advantage of one-on-one matchups. That's why I like Dak Prescott. That's what he did extraordinarily well. Cowboy fans should be excited. And for once, I'm in agreement with Jerry Jones. Do not bring Johnny Manziel in. Do not let him hurt your clubhouse. I don't think the kid is ready to play at the NFL. Dak Prescott is the future in Dallas.
Yep, I agree with you there, too. I was, you know, very excited when the Cowboys got Prescott in the draft. You know, like we mentioned, you know, he got a DUI and that made him drop some. You know, I tend to not shy away from those guys that kind of have a little bit of those question marks coming in, you know, like the, you know, sometimes to a fault. You know, I like I said, I spent a late first-round pick on DGB in two dynasty leagues, and that hasn't really paid off so far. But, you know, there's plenty of guys that have came in with, you know, kind of the question marks coming in, you know, your Dez Bryants that turn out just fine and have great careers, you know. So I was excited to get Prescott. You know, obviously you don't want to overreact too much, but definitely encouraged by this first week's performance. We'll kind of, you know, speed through these last couple guys, you know, the top five players in the preseason week one, so we can get to our DFS stuff. But the next guy was, you know, he started the season off with a nice 43-yard touchdown grab. That's Vance McDonald, tight end. You know, he at times last year had a few times where he was fantasy relevant, put up some decent games down the stretch. Do you think that he is, you know, by far and away going to be the starter there in San Francisco, and where do you like his fantasy value?
I clearly think the 6'4", 267-pound Rice Owl alumnus is going to be the starter in San Francisco. He's a three-year veteran. Last year, he had his most productive season with 30 catches for 326 yards and three touchdowns. And he's been impressive. And he's in Chip Kelly's high-volume offense. He might be very productive. He is clearly just outside the top 12. I have him ranked about number 15 right now. And I think wise fantasy fans are going to pick him up. If you don't want to invest in a top 10 tight end, I think Vance McDonald is one of those guys you can go and grab.
Yep, I agree with you there completely. You know, with that Chip Kelly offense, there is a chance for, you know, that tight end to put up some numbers, so he is a good late target. Next guy, kind of been a disappointment thus far in his career, but I still have hope in him. I'm still hanging on to him in one dynasty league. That's the third receiver in Denver, Cody Latimer. You know, was very productive in this week one of preseason, which, you know, obviously, like we said, you kind of got to take with a grain of salt, playing a lot of vanilla defenses. But I do like seeing these flashes because Latimer was a guy I was pretty high on when he was coming into the league. So I'm still holding that hope that he can carve out, you know, a little bit of a role as that third receiver in Denver and hopefully establish some roots for down the road to really step into hopefully maybe, you know, being one of the top two guys on that offense.
You know, Jordan, I'm a Broncos fan. I think we've discussed that before. Mm-hmm. So I was very happy when the Broncos selected Latimer. In 2013, he was the Hoosiers' leading receiver with 72 catches for 1,096 yards and nine touchdowns. Now, during the pre-draft process, Cody Latimer rocketed up draft boards. He was so impressive, and people went back and saw his tape, and they really thought that this kid at 6'2", 215 pounds, nice catch radius and soft hands, that he could make an impact in the NFL. Unfortunately, sometimes wide receivers take a little longer than we expect. But against Chicago, you alluded to it. He was very good with seven catches for 82 yards. I still like him. My only concern, the Broncos have a low-volume passing offense. They are going to run the football and play defense. That front seven with Denver and their secondary is just spectacular. And Wade Phillips is a fantastic coach. So he's going to play behind Demaryius Thomas and Emmanuel Sanders. However, if either Thomas or Sanders gets hurt, Latimer should step onto the field and he should garner targets. So I think he's the type of guy in DFS and in season-long and dynasty leagues. We have to watch him very closely. I still like his upside.
Yep, agree completely there. Then the last guy we'll talk about, you know, kind of makes it a little bit, you know, a little bit of a question mark there in San Francisco with that running back spot. That was Mike Davis. You know, he really exploded, was, turning nothing into big gains almost every single time he touched the ball. You know, really looked, you know, explosive, shifty out there. So what do you think happens with the San Francisco running back situation? Like, I personally, I think Carlos Hyde is a guy to own there. But when you're looking down the depth chart a little bit, I think it gets a little interesting when you're looking at, you know, Mike Davis and Sean Drone, and who would be that number two guy that would step in as the, you know, the every down back if Hyde were to get hurt again. What are your thoughts on Mike Davis as it, you know, stands, you know, as of, you know, the end of week one in the preseason?
So I agree with you. Carlos Hyde is the guy you want, but if you're a handcuff guy and you want to remain invested in this 49ers high volume offense, and we know Chip Kelly is very productive with his running backs, I think I'm going to go for Mike Davis and let someone else grab Sean Drone, because you can basically get Mike Davis for nothing right now. Now, the South Carolina product is 5'9", 217 pounds. He is a powerful little wrecking ball. In 2013, he was second team all SEC with 1,183 yards rushing. From a scouting point, he is a North Scout runner with good vision, low center of gravity, and good cutback ability. He keeps moving his feet in traffic, and he uses a spin move to break into the open field. I think Mike Davis can be productive, and I would not be surprised by the beginning of the season that Mike Davis is number two on the depth chart. I like him a ton, and I would rather have him than Sean Drone right now.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, kind of an interesting take. I know you look at some of the news that came out recently, and it said that, you know, Sean Drone is the unquestioned number two back there, but, you know, if Davis keeps performing like that, I think that, like you said, it's going to get a little bit interesting there, and Davis might be the guy to own towards the end of the year. So let's kind of transition into, you know, our next topic, you know, kind of what we wanted, you know, the meat of the show to be about. We wanted to, you know, kind of dive into, you know, DFS a little bit, even though, you know, it's still pretty early, so we'll just call it our way too early week one DFS preview. You know, you recently, you know, downloaded, you know, some of the salary spreadsheet, sent that over to me since, you know, I live in an awesome state where DFS is, you know, outlawed. So I kind of have to go these workaround ways to get these salaries so I can, you know, pretend to put together a DFS squad. But, you know, you put together a squad, and I, you know, I got this pulled up right here in front of me. You know, you started off with Jameis Winston, which I love. You know, salary $6,600. You know, that's a pretty decent value there. You know, you look down the rest of your roster, you got, you know, some nice PPR running backs there. You know, you loaded up with your two starting wide receivers, which is a great strategy. I like the Dwayne Allen dart throw at the end there. You know, you got Mike Evans as a flex there, so that tells you what you know, the rest of your wide receiver depth is. So just kind of take me a little bit through this, through the process of putting together this roster and what you went, well, you know, kind of what your thought process was with each guy, and then I'll just, you know, kind of let you take it there and kind of go, you know, player by player.
So, absolutely. So, the one thing is, I like to learn from people who are smarter than me, and I basically have learned over the last 2 years to become a better DFS player. Now, obviously, I played fantasy football for years, but the game has evolved. There is so much information. So I basically start putting together my lineup with, and I focus on three strategies as I'm organizing my team. The first thing I'm going to look at is the over-under in Vegas. Look it. Vegas is financially incentivized to get the over-unders right. It is not about who's going to win. It's about getting action on both sides of the bids. They want the middle. They want to make their money by having 50-50 and getting the vig. So these people are smarter, doing more homework than me. So I'm going to look at the over-unders every week, and I'm going to target those three top games. And then what I'll do is I'll highlight the two bottom games and say to myself, I'm going to probably eliminate players from these two games unless I see something that is just an outlier, like maybe it's a terrible run defense and the guy could score by running back against them in a low-scoring contest. Could get 100 yards and two touchdowns. But I'm going with over-under in Vegas. Then my second aspect that I'm looking at is opponent rank against defenses. Now, I do not typically look at season-long. This game evolves from week to week. Too many players are injured. Coaching staffs watch the film. What I usually do is look at the last month rankings. So if I'm in week 9 of the NFL season, I'm going to look for weeks 8, 7, 6, and 5. What are the worst defenses against the pass, and who are the worst defenses against the run? Because that is, to me, a little bit more reflective than the entire season. So it's a little hard early in the season because you have to make some adjustments with new coaching staffs, draft picks, free agent signings. But you still have to kind of make the same shell of your ideas. And then the last one that I'm really big on is I try to get the top quarterback wide receiver combo that I feel like I can use that week. Because if you're going to win a GPP, or, and I even do it in cash games. Now, some people don't like that. They think it's too risky. I tend to disagree. I've always gone with quarterback wide receiver combos from Peyton Manning to Marvin Harrison. I used to love in San Francisco when we had Jeff Garcia and Terrell Owens. I used to love to pair those two up. I have always been a quarterback receiver combo, especially in a good matchup. I'm not afraid of it. So those are the big three things that I'm looking for. So when I put together this lineup that you're talking about, if anyone wants to go to Gridiron Skull 91, you can see the lineup posted. It was posted yesterday, August 15th. The first lineup that I really want, the first aspect I looked for, was I wanted Jameis Winston and Mike Evans. One, I think it's going to be low owned. But I'm not as afraid of that Atlanta defense as some other people are. And I have confidence in Winston, and I have confidence in this Tampa Bay passing attack this year. And I think the price is right. I want to get big receivers, but I want to spend. Winston is only $6,600, and I like Evans. He's pretty far down the chart. Because he did not have a lot of touchdowns, I think he's undervalued at $7,400. So I like that. Now, I know Marcus Trufant is a problem, but in the second matchup last year when Winston was playing better and Evans was played a little better down the stretch, he scored 17 points against Trufant. So I like that. Then I decided I was going to go heavy in wide receivers. So I like a little bit under the, I didn't want to go with the big three. I felt like Julio Jones, Beckham, Hopkins, they were a little bit more expensive. So I said, you know what? I'm not going to go. And DeAndre Hopkins, I'm not going to go there. I went down the board a little bit, and I loved Allen Robinson. He's at home against Green Bay. The over-under in that game is a very solid. I like it very much. Let me go here. A 48. I took that. I also love the over-under in Dallas against the Giants at 49.5. So I wanted a piece of that offense. So I took Dez Bryant.
Well, and it also seems like every year when the Cowboys open up against the Giants, it's always a shootout too. And it always seems like, you know, when Romo's right, that's, you know, a 300-plus yard passing game. And usually Dez gets his fair share of those targets as well. So I like that play quite a bit in, you know, a one-week league right there. I think that that's a much better value than, you know, really splurging, like you mentioned, those top receivers. I think getting, you know, Dez Bryant, Allen Robinson for $8,500 and $8,300 respectively is excellent, excellent value.
Thank you, Jordan. I really think that's a nice combo. I've done three lineups, and each one has Bryant and Robinson. Now, this is Sunday-only games, everyone. And remember, there's two games on Monday, and the Broncos open up against the Panthers on Thursday night. So there are, you know, some play, obviously, six quarterbacks are off the board. So then I said, you know what? Since I'm going with this heavy wide receiver, but DraftKings is a PPR, and I think there are still fantasy fans who are reluctant to have confidence in straight PPR running backs.
Oh, I'm all in on that strategy.
Me, you know, Jordan, I really embraced it in about week 6 last year. Early in the year, I was like paying up for Jamal Charles. I was paying up for Le'Veon Bell when he came back. And I was spending a lot of this money, my salary cap, on these stud runners. But I always looked to see the guys who led my cash games. and they always went with the Danny Woodheads, you know, Dion Lewis's. And I said, John, you got to wake up here. Open up, my friend. Open your mind. Don't live in the dark ages. Go with the PPR. Nah, I'm a history teacher, so I love those analogies. Go back. I said, you know what? I'm going to embrace in DraftKings. And once I started buying guys like Woodhead, James White, Duke Johnson, Charles Sims, I went from being like in cash games, like in the 40 percentile, I was going up to the 10 percentile. Now, there's risk. You could lose on a PPR running back, but you're not paying a lot. So what I did was I looked and I said, look at man, Duke Johnson against Philadelphia. I'm embracing the PPR running back. I'm going. Duke Johnson is so far down the board, my friend. 5,100. But what I like, Philadelphia is 28th against running backs. I'm embracing my boy Duke. I love Duke. I'm all in. I'm taking him week one against Philadelphia. And I know you like him because I've listened to your stuff, read your stuff. Our boy.
Yeah, yeah. Theo Riddick. I love that value at 4,000. That is insane. When you're looking at, you know, like we said, Dez Bryant at 8,500. When you can get Theo Riddick for less than half of that in a PPR league, you're doing something right.
Yeah, and I say to myself, look at this over-under. 49.5. I also say, what's the game flow?
That's gonna
what
be...
what if my friend, the Colts get out to a 17-0 lead? Well, what's going to happen?
Stafford's gonna air that thing out.
Throw the football. Can Theo Riddick get 7 passes for 80 yards and a touchdown at a 4,000 salary cap? Absolutely. I'm all in on Theo Riddick. You have to be comfortable. Now, Theo Riddick could go out, and we know that he has a floor, and he could be problematic in that floor, but I'm going to go with the over-under and the game flow, and there's always risk in anything you do in life, especially DFS, and I'm going to go with my $4,000 man. I'm going to go Theo Riddick. I love it. There's my lineup. You had alluded to it. Dwayne Allen. I'm going to go with Dwayne Allen because I love the over-under. He's very cheap at 3,200. Now, I'm a little bit counterintuitive on defenses. I know a lot of people are going to say don't pay for defense. But one of the things that I noticed whenever I looked at the top 5 lineups in cash games, what I started to notice over the first 5-6 weeks of the season, winning lineups had money and they spent on defense. The Broncos last year, the Panthers last year. Now, what I've decided to do, and then once I started paying up, and we discussed this, I believe, on last week's podcast, I'm looking for a defense that is playing at home, that is a 7-point favorite, and an over-under less than 45. Well, I see the Eagles. They're a 7.5-point favorite against the turnover-prone RG3 at home in what I believe will be a low-volume game. I think the Eagles are going to slow it down, and I have concerns about the Browns putting up 30 points. So I like the Eagles in that matchup. And the other one that stands out is the Chiefs, but I couldn't get them under the salary cap. But the Chiefs, they're 7.5-point favorite at home in a 43.5 over-under. So I really like the Chiefs and the Eagles. In the lineup I put together, I took the Eagles.
Yep, I think that's a smart strategy there. You know, it makes sense, you know, when you look at, like, you know, the people that are going to be winning these DFS tournaments, they're going to have the best players in their lineup. You know, that includes your defense as well. So I have no problem spending a little bit on a defense there. You know, so you look at the rest of your roster. The one player that I thought was, you know, a little risky, you know, you play, you know, rookie Tyler Boyd in, you know, week one. I think that's kind of a ballsy call there a little bit. So kind of talk about that a little bit.
Well, in order to get those 3 stud wide receivers, I do understand that somewheres I have to take a risk, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, some people are going to tell me that Theo Riddick is risky, but Tyler Boyd with – without Tyler Eifert and problems at the tight end position, the depth chart, Tyler Boyd is likely to start in the slot, and I think he's going to see a lot of action. We also know opening week, the Jets are going to double team A.J. Green, and they're going to make someone else on the Browns offense beat them. I'm worried that they're going to have to keep Giovanni Bernard in the backfield or Jeremy Hill to block this tremendous front four of the Jets. I'm not sure Bernard is going to be able to get out into the passing game as much as we want, because I know the Jets defensively are going to attack the Bengals. I believe the game flow and the game plan dictates that Tyler Boyd is going to be on a lot of one-on-one matchups. Now, while he lacks elite deep speed and he's not a burner, what he's very good is he beats his man in short areas. And I think he's going to be the hot receiver. So what I think is he's going to be able to get 7 or 8 targets. He has great hands. So I'm going to bank on 5 or 6 receptions. And I think he's going to go for 70 to 80 yards. For the 3,600, if I can get 12 to 15 points on that, I feel great. And then what if he scores? All of a sudden, I have a 20-point day. I have to take a risk on one player every week for under $4,000 in order to get those big stud receivers in. And this is where the art comes in. You know, we talked about it earlier in the podcast. The art is, what is the game flow? What are the matchups? What are the Jets going to do against the Bengals? I like Tyler Boyd for 3,600.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned you like taking a risk on some of those, you know, lower salary type players. So let's, you know, kind of go through the list here. And, you know, you kind of mentioned, or you kind of pulled aside some of the, you know, bargain basement salary guys that you like. So let's go through a couple of those guys for the people out there. So when they're kind of planning ahead for their week one DFS action, just some guys to kind of keep in mind when you're looking for those end of the roster fillers so you can, you know, stack up on a couple superstars. Let's start at quarterback. The guy that you kind of had picked there was, you know, Joe Flacco against the Buffalo Bills. His salary is, you know, $6,700. I do like that play a little bit. I'm a little nervous. You know, that Buffalo defense under Rex Ryan has the potential to be pretty stout. So what made you kind of feel a little confident in Flacco in week one?
So I know it's interesting because people are going to be concerned about Buffalo's defense. But now losing Reggie Ragland, and then their number one pick, Shaq Lawson isn't going to play. They have invested a lot of draft capital in the offseason on that defense, and they're falling. So I look at a roster right now, my friend, that I'm not convinced that Buffalo is going to be that dominant defense from week one. Now, if this game was up in Buffalo, I'm not sure if I would be that interested. But it's in Baltimore, and I feel pretty good. The Bills were the 16th ranked defense against a quarterbacks last year. So I like that with Flacco. Flacco also scored 19.1 DraftKings points last year as a fantasy quarterback, and that was largely missed by fantasy fans. He also had some big games against Jacksonville, 26 points, San Diego, 25 points, Cleveland, 24 points, Oakland, 25, Cincinnati, 24. I feel at home that Joe Flacco can easily exceed 20 points this week, week one, against the Bills. And let me look the over-under. So you're taking a risk because it's a 43. But I'm looking to save a quarterback. I like Flacco a ton there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not as high on him there, especially in this week one matchup. I think, you know, if you're spending $6,700 on Flacco, I'd rather just do what you did and, you know, save $100 and pick up Jameis Winston against those Falcons. But, you know, if you're not a Jameis guy, I think that Flacco is, you know, a decent target in that same price range. Moving over to the running back position, you know, like similar to where your team went with, you know, Duke Johnson, Theoretic, a couple of the cheaper salary guys. A few more that you like there is Charles Sims at $4,400 against the Falcons, and then DeAndre Washington at $3,700 versus the Saints, which I think is a very savvy pick. So talk about those just a little bit there.
Absolutely. So the reason I didn't take Charles Sims before is once I invested in, obviously, Mike Evans and Jameis Winston, it took Charles Sims off the board for me. I would be extremely reluctant to take a wide receiver, a running back, and a quarterback on a DFS lineup. I guess it could be done, but I would be, it'd have to be in a perfect scenario. But the over-under in this game is 48. And the Falcons are favored, which tells me that Vegas thinks that Tampa Bay is going to have to play catch-up. And if Tampa Bay has to come from behind, if they fell behind by 10 points, which is possible on the road against Atlanta, well, that means Charles Sims is going to get on the field even sooner than he expected. And then I went back, my friend. Look at his final games. 18 points against Carolina. 21 points against Chicago. 10 points against the Rams. 13 points against New Orleans. Earlier in the year, 16 points against the Eagles week 11. Charles Sims is involved. And for $4,400, I'm willing to take him if you don't want to go Jameis Winston and Mike Evans. And then I watch very closely DeAndre Washington in that game for the Raiders this weekend. Now, I wasn't as high on him coming out of the draft process because he's 5'8", a little over 200 pounds, and I do believe there's value in Latavius Murray in season long. But what I saw is I think he's going to carve out that Charles Sims, Theo Riddick role in Oakland. He's going to be on the field. And you know what I liked, which really set my radar off, my friend? That over-under is 51, baby! Vegas believes that 51 points are going to be on the board. What they also do is the Saints are only 1.5-point favorite. So they believe that this game is going to be something like 28-27. Wow, that's a lot of points and a lot of passing. Let's go back to game flow. What if the Saints, if I told you the Saints jumped out to a 21-7 lead, do you think that's crazy, Jordan?
No, I mean, not at all. I think you've seen that happen plenty of times.
So then who's going to be on the field for the Raiders? Is it going to be Washington or Latavius
Murray? It's
going to
be that pass-catching back, absolutely. It's, you know, the same thing we said with Theo Riddick, you know, in Detroit. There's, you know, possible Colts jump out to a quick lead.
Absolutely. So I figure I'm going to take a risk. Let me take DeAndre Washington at 3,700. So like you said earlier, if you don't like a Tyler Boyd, well, maybe you don't want to go that low for a receiver. Maybe you want to go for DeAndre Washington. You're more comfortable with that. Now, he's a rookie, so there's risk there. But I do like DeAndre Washington for 3,700.
Yeah, but I think that's a smart play there. That's definitely something to keep tucked in your back pocket there, because I don't think that's a name that a lot of people are going to be playing in that week one, and I do think it's a guy that could pay off for you pretty big. Moving over to the wide receivers, you got Marvin Jones at 4,600 versus the Colts. There's been the reports that have came out that said at times that Marvin Jones has been the best receiver in, you know, Lions camp. Same thing that we mentioned, you know, game flow. There's a good chance, you know, that this is a very high-scoring game. The ball's going to get thrown around the yard a lot. You know, you could look for Marvin Johnson to be a sneaky play for, you know, 60, 70 yards and a touchdown. That wouldn't surprise me at all there in week one. Other wide receiver you like there at 4,700, so just a little bit more expensive, was Kamar Aiken versus, you know, that Buffalo game. So that's a game that you're kind of coming back to again as well, that Buffalo-Baltimore game. You kind of mentioned, you know, maybe stacking Flacco, Aiken. And then your tight end for your values is Clive Walford at 3,000 versus Minnesota. So just kind of talk about those trio of pass catchers there a little bit.
Absolutely. So what I noticed right away when I'm looking at Vegas, when I have a 50-point over-under Colts versus Lions, I say to myself, I have to look at this game. And what I do, the Colts are 5.5-point favorites. So Vegas believes that the game flow dictates that the Colts are going to get on top. Well, if the Colts get on top, they're going to throw the football to Detroit. And I'm not convinced they're going to have a great running game. But then I looked at the salaries. I'm like, let's see. Golden Tate, $7,300. That's pricey. Wait a second. Marvin Jones, $4,600. Whoa, I can save $2,700 in salary. The Colts are the 26th ranked defense against the pass last year. I don't think the Colts have done a lot to upgrade. I question their ability to rush the passer, which means if you give Stafford time, he can make completions, which also says I think they're going to take their shots down the field with Jones. I think Jones will have at least three deep balls thrown to him, and I expect him to at least make one catch over 40 yards. So I'm going to invest for $4,600 in Marvin Jones. Then, going back, I like to take the quarterback and match him up with my receiver. And then I looked at the salary, and I'm like, Kamar Aiken is only $4,700. And to me, he's the clear number one guy in Baltimore. And check this out. These are his DraftKings points starting in week 12, my friend, where Aiken really ascended to the top of the depth chart in Baltimore. 20 points against Cleveland, 11 points Miami, 14 points Seattle, 30 points Kansas City, 15 points Pittsburgh, 12 points Cincinnati. Bingo, I'm all in, $4,700. He will get targets. I expect Flacco to target Aiken at least 11 times in this game. I'll take it for the salary cap. And then if I want a long shot dart at tight end, I'll go with Clive Walford. The over-under is great at 51. I don't have any wide receivers. I don't have Amari Cooper, and I don't have Michael Crabtree. I'm going to go deep down this depth chart, and I'm going to go Clyde Walford. Maybe I get lucky with four catches for 50 yards, and what if he scored for me for $3,000? I'll take it.
Yep, absolutely right there. I agree. I like all three of those plays right there. All right, and that will wrap up, you know, our way too early DFS preview. We'll definitely come circle back around and touch on it again when we get, you know, probably after, you know, finish up the preseason when we go to a more regular two or three shows per week. We'll touch on all this DFS stuff again. But for now, you know, John, you know, what do you have coming up at Football Diehards? Anything you want to plug?
Well, we always have stuff. Now, really, the content on the site is starting to turn DFS and draft oriented for your season long. There is so much good stuff. There are podcasts up there. There are rankings. You still have my college fantasy football information. And if you want to have and learn about college fantasy football, I was so lucky to partake in an expert's Joe's vs. Pros season long college fantasy football contest at Fantrax. On Thursday, we are having a 14-team, two-quarterback draft where we have eight pros against six Joes. And then what we are doing is we have six satellite leagues, 12 Joes per league, and the winners of each league get to play in next year's Pros vs. Joes Championship League. Please follow along at Fantrax. Follow me on Twitter at GridironSkull91. Hit me up with any questions. And I've had so much fun today, Jordan. I can't wait for football to begin.
Yeah, I'm going to have to have you get me in one of these college football leagues. I've never done one of those before, so I think that'd be a good way to really, you know, expand my football knowledge even more as, you know, really dive into that college football game. So I'm going to have you get me in one of those leagues. You know, on my side of things, you know, I've been doing a lot of work on the site. You can check us out now at www.redrockfantasyfootball.com. I'm kind of in the process of maybe setting up a different site to switch that same domain name over to. But for now, you know, you can check that out. We got, you know, my first written article up on the site kind of talking about Amir Abdullah and Theo Riddick being value plays at their current ADP. So, you know, we're going to have more written content coming there as well. You know, obviously, you're a basketball fan. Check out, you know, the Locked On Fantasy Basketball podcast and my other past podcast, my Dynasty B-Ball, Dynasty Fantasy Basketball podcast. For the fantasy baseball fans out there, make sure to check out, you know, the Red Rock Fantasy Baseball podcast. So, you know, we're really, really working with a big network here of just different podcasts that are all kind of intertwined here a little bit. You know, if you like the podcast, please give us a review on iTunes, whether it's, you know, a good or a bad one. The more review and the more feedback you can get, the better. So I guess if that's everything, John, we'll talk to you next week.
Excellent. Enjoy the knowledge, everyone, and look forward to talking next week with you, Jordan.
Absolutely. All right. Have a good one, guys.